nor have we been wanting in attentions to our British brethren. They too have been deaf to the voice of justice and of consanguinity. We must, therefore, acquiesce in the necessity which denounces our separation, and hold them, as we hold the rest of mankind, enemies in war, in peace, friends.
Welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. Here's a question to begin our episode today. How did the world learn about the Declaration of Independence? Well, this is the story. On the night of the 4th of July, 1776, after Congress had approved of the final text, a handwritten copy of the Declaration was sent to a local Philadelphia printer by the name of John Dunlap. Mr. Dunlap worked throughout the night printing about 200 copies of the Declaration for distribution around the colonies and indeed around the world. These are called the Dunlap broadsides. From these original 200 broadsides, newspapers were able to print thousands and thousands of additional copies. The first American newspaper to publish the text of the Declaration was the Pennsylvania Evening Post on the 6th of July. General George Washington ordered that the Declaration be read to his troops in New York City on the 9th of July, and the British General William Howe, who was commander-in-chief of the British Army in North America, learned of the Declaration probably around the same time. Howe then sent copies of the Declaration back to London, and British newspapers started reporting on the Declaration within weeks. And so word of American independence began to spread around the world. But back to the Dunlap broadsides. There are only about 26 known copies of the Dunlap broadsides in existence today, and many of them are at the British National Archives in Kew, England. And I'm very excited today because I have two expert guests from the National Archives to talk to me about their collection of Dunlap broadsides, as well as their upcoming exhibit about the Declaration of Independence at the Archives. Links to that will be in the show notes, but here with me today are two archival historians at the National Archives, Dr. Graham Moore and Dr. Sean Cunningham. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
Well, thanks for being here. Why don't we just start by talking about these precious copies of the Declaration of Independence that you have at the National Archives. How did you acquire them? Why are they significant? And how do you preserve them?
So we have at the National Archives here six early copies of the Declaration of Independence. Well, five early copies and one copy from them. We have three of the original Philadelphia Dunlap prints. We also have one very mysterious Baltimore Dunlap print, which we think was printed very shortly afterwards. And we have a Hugh Gaine print as well. And we also now hold a version that was laid before the House of Lords a couple of years later on as well. Our Philadelphia Dunlaps were all sent to Britain by various colonial officials and military officers active in North America at the time. For example, we have the earliest one that was sent back was sent on the 28th of July, 1776, by Vice Admiral Howe to Richard Stevens, the Secretary of the Admiralty in Britain. We also have a copy that was enclosed in a letter to George Germain by Lord Dunmore, Governor of Virginia, on the 4th of August, 1776. And on top of that, we also have a final Dunlap copy, which was found a lot more recently by a visitor to the National Archives, actually, which was enclosed in a letter sent privately by a merchant in Philadelphia to one of his contacts in Amsterdam. And that letter was dated the 24th of July, 1776. And finally, on top of that as well, we have a version which was enclosed in a letter by the so-called peace commissioners to America. That's Richard and William Howe, the two brothers, one as general and commander-in-chief of the army, and one as a vice admiral and commander-in-chief of the navy in the area. And that was also enclosed to George Germain on the 11th of August, 1776.
Who was George Germain?
George Germain at the time was the Secretary of State for the colonies. So he was responsible for the management of Britain's colonies, particularly the American colonies. And he was Secretary of State for the Colonies from 1775 to 1782.
Okay. Did any of this come as a surprise to them?
I think so. The tone we get from the letters that they're enclosed with is sort of along the lines of this is the most recent installment in a long list of what they would view as colonial misdeeds by the rebels in America. They don't seem too surprised by the concept of independence, but I don't think at this stage they're convinced that it's going to be a permanent problem. I think there is still some view from the British perspective that this will be resolved. It is, of course, a change in gear, though, very much, this sort of tone shift. We go from the earlier communications by the Continental Congress, for example, back to Britain, where they sort of communicate that they very much still want to be part of the British colonial system, simply on better terms. And then this shifts now with the Declaration of Independence, where they are now talking about a full removal from the British colonial system and becoming a nation in their own right.
I suppose that shift from the tone of the Olive Branch petition pretty much a year earlier to the Declaration might have come as a rather rapid change of emphasis and change of belief. And certainly when we see the tone that Franklin had at the Staten Island Peace Conference, which Howe goes to, which I think triggers some of these declarations being sent as evidence of that sudden, more kind of resistant and resilient American view of their own status. I think that suddenly causes this flurry of postings back from various colonial officials, various military officials. So that's why, obviously, it's been printed and it's in circulation, but the attempt to negotiate a peace on its appearance suggests the British were slightly concerned of how it might accelerate from that point and how it might be an inspiring statement.
Mm.
So I think that's where the attention that the British give it kind of generates. It's the reaction and looking to the immediate future of what it might inspire.
I would say on that, actually, that I think the comments that the two Howe brothers sort of have in their letter alongside when they enclose the declaration, quite pertinent there. They say that it is our duty to acquaint your lordship that on the 4th of July last, the General Congress declared independence. But they also talk about how this is affecting their negotiations. So they have a quote in that letter where they talk about how George Washington will no longer receive letters from the two of them unless, I'm quoting here again, the superscription specified his military titles, which of course would have been revoked when he entered rebellion against the crown. So they are now seeing this shift to sort of self-actualization on behalf of America, which is changing the way they have to negotiate.
Fascinating. In your exhibit at the National Archives coming up, are we going to be able to see the letters that were enclosed with the Declaration of Independence as well?
We're actually not planning those for display, although I can say that one of the declarations is actually going on loan to the United States, to the Museum of the American Revolution. And they will also be showing there the letters that it was enclosed within. And that's the letter that was written by the Philadelphia merchant who enclosed a copy of the Declaration to Amsterdam.
Okay, and we're going to get back to a lot of this, but I do want to just talk a little bit here at the start about the exhibit, and then we'll talk more about some of the other historical aspects that are interesting to you. So can one of you just talk a little bit about the exhibit coming up at the National Archives, please?
So the exhibition we're planning is called Revolution 250, and it's going to tell the story of the American Revolution starting in 1763 at the Treaty of Paris at the end of the Seven Years' War and ending with another Treaty of Paris in 1783 at the end of the American Revolutionary War. And what we're really looking at here is what changes over this 20-year period to have this escalation of dissent and discontent in the American colonies. But we're also very interested in how these sort of boiling pot of ideas about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness that are referenced in the Declaration of Independence, how different people are interpreting those in different ways over this 20-year period. So we look at a variety of perspectives, from rebels or patriots to loyalists and British and indigenous nations and enslaved people and black loyalists over the course of our exhibition. And we think about how they interpret these ideas about liberty that are expressed in the Declaration and how they affect their day-to-day lives as this sort of ongoing crisis deepens in North America.
It's really a story of the British decline, I suppose, a rapid decline from the high point of the end of the Seven Years' War, pushing the French out of the 13 colonies and that threat disappearing, and then the sudden pressure that they're then exercised by Westminster, by London, across the Atlantic to change the way the colonies sit in relation to the motherland, to Britain. And that causes a rapid shift in perspective from the way Washington talks about, and Jefferson talk about, and Franklin, the colonial kind of contribution to that 7 Years' War, the American and Indian War, in protecting their own frontiers and keeping that part of the empire safe for Britain. Suddenly the pressure to repay some of those costs with the pressure for taxation, it suddenly causes quite a rapid shift across the board. And there's these points of acceleration through this 20 years where we can really see individual actions or pieces of legislation causing an immediate response on the streets or in people's minds. So it's setting that scene for the decline and eventual expulsion of the British from the 13 colonies and how that changes the balance of the empire, obviously staying in Canada and Spanish in the south and in the west. So it's a crucial 20 years in the kind of establishment of how Britain sees itself in the world, how it relates to France and Spain and Holland and other countries, but obviously then incorporating this new republic across the Atlantic and how that changes the dynamics of Britain's self-perception as well.
Yeah, I often think of the period for, say, 10 years after the Seven Years' War as actually a battle of historical narrative, which is something that we see, you know, archivists preserving. On the one hand, you have the British and the British Army and the British Navy saying, well, we clearly won the 7 Years' War. But the, you know, George Washington and the colonial militia and the regimental state militias or state armies, however you want to call them, thought that they were responsible for winning the war. And they didn't like the fact that the professional British soldiers and the British government felt that basically they were carrying the water for the victory over France. And that narrative did actually drive much of the conflict in those intervening years. And we're going to talk more about that. But I just kind of have an amateur question about preserving documents. First of all, it's always amazing that we have these archives. You know, a document from 1776 is printed on paper. I don't know what kind of paper, anything like that. So how does the pieces of paper actually just survive the original trip, right? And how quickly do they start deteriorating? And how quickly, say, did you realize in the government records in 1776 that these need to be preserved and kept and that we still have them today?
Well, they're in a specific series, which is the collections of colonial papers from America and the West Indies, as they're called. So most of them are in the series called CO5, which is a lot of correspondence, but a lot of enclosures, a lot of maps which have been extracted. So these arrived as, I suppose, working papers in the 19th century from various government record stores. Our archive was established by an Act of Parliament in the 1830s, but not actually physically built as a building till the 1850s. So there was a process of assessment, preparation, and then transfer in to create the archive itself. So in that intervening period, a lot of these papers were taken out of their packets, they were flattened, they were bound into volumes, effectively in date order, to create an artificial sequence, which is very much the Victorian kind of approach to synthesizing diverse collections. They did it with Henry VIII state papers, literally created a sequence from an artificial point of view. It didn't really reflect the dynamics or the provenance of those letters. So to some extent, the CO5 material also loses that connection to the processes and the people and the places that helped to create this archive. And within it, there's a lot of private papers, as you call them, official papers, private papers. There's an overlap between how officials, colonial officials and military people kind of consider their positions and what is their personal correspondence, what is their private correspondence. So a lot of it is lumped together. Some of it survives in related series, but they're classified as private papers because they've been gifted or deposited at later times, often in place of inheritance taxes from the great families who were involved in the conflict or were the colonial architects and administrators. So altogether, we've got this merged collection. So it's managed in the same way as all the other papers, now kept in temperature, humidity-controlled repositories, fully logged in an archival retrieval system so we can see who's using it, how frequently they're produced, and that dictates how we manage the space and locating them near the reading rooms. A lot of this material has been digitized on big academic websites by companies like Adam Matthew and ProQuest, which has basically taken them out of immediate access online, so it's paywall supplied information, but obviously they're still free to view in the building here at Kew, so anyone can come and look at this material. And we've had to sift through many thousands of these letters to find the narrative and link them to the story what we want to tell. And obviously we're pitching the exhibition as a public event, which will hopefully tell a story that a lot of British people aren't very familiar with, because this is not really a period which is very prominent in our education system at the moment. So hopefully we're going to change people's minds about how America and Britain were related through this conflict and then this rather swift resolution into a more harmonious relationship. But in that sense, it's really exciting to be able to dive into this collection to find some very hidden stories, especially around the role of women, around Indigenous nations and Black loyalists and enslaved people, who are a very strong part of the visibility of the collection and how those stories are kind of accessed. So as well as telling the familiar narrative of the battles and the ideas and the individuals who everybody knows about, we're trying to see how it affected individuals a lot more and how people had to make decisions about what was right in front of them as events unfolded around them. So in that sense, we go up and down the social scale. We travel across the whole of the 13 colonies and a bit beyond as well to get this sense of how this draws people's attention, how it makes them make tough decisions, and what the consequences of those were.
Very interesting, Sean. I'm interested also in learning a little bit about how you're going to present the actual parchment, the actual document itself. This is extremely fragile, right? So what is the process of taking this out of its sort of Fort Knox of archives? I mean, and these are valuable documents too. I mean, monetarily valuable, but also extremely valuable for history. And they can't be sort of mishandled. So how are you managing all of that?
So for valuable documents like this, and not just because of their monetary value, but also their historical value and the fact that they might be particularly delicate, we do usually extract these documents from the boxes they would ordinarily be stored in the Colonial Office series, as Sean discusses. And they go to our safe room, which means that they can be viewed under supervision by anyone who comes to the archives. You'd have to request to view them, then go to the invigilation room where you can view them safely. They have also undergone various amounts of conservation work, not always in the way that we do it now, though. So these are printed materials. They're printed on reasonably high quality paper in Philadelphia in July 76. And they're actually still in very good shape today. There's fold lines, for example, where they've been folded up into the letters that they were posted in. All of ours are full paper. There's a few versions of the Dunlaps I know which are, but only half remains. Ours were all the full thing. But they do have a few places where they've needed sort of tear repairs along those fold lines and things like that. But a couple decades ago, they were also mounted on sort of a paper backing, with a little gaps left so you can see where things have been written on the back. There's some really interesting details like there with, on the back where they talk about, this is enclosure number 3, for example, in my letters. And with those remain, you can still see those. But the problem with that backing now is that we have teams of heritage scientists here at the National Archives who are doing lots of really interesting work with various scientific instruments looking at these documents and documents like this. And what we'd really like to do is get a sense of where, for example, in the print order of the original Dunlap printings, these are. And one way to do that would be to look at the impressions of the print itself. So the sort of depth of the impression of the print, to my understanding, allows you to make decisions about whether you think this was an early use of the printing block or a later use of the printing block. And we now can't do that very easily because they've been mounted on this paper. So sometimes these efforts to conserve can slightly impede historical research later down the line. But of course, it does also mean that people can view and handle them more easily and access those records here.
And we'll be able to see them at the exhibit.
Yes.
The originals.
We will be displaying one original here at the exhibit. Others are going out on loan to other institutions. The American Museum in Bath, for example, here in Britain, is also displaying one of our copies over the next year. But we will have a copy on display here. So the copy we're displaying is going to be the one that was enclosed by Vice Admiral Howe. So this was the one that was sent to the Admiralty Secretary, Richard Stevens, And that is the version that we're displaying.
Nice. A quick question, again technical, about the ink. What is the challenge of preserving ink over all of this time?
I think ink is quite stable in paper because it gets absorbed. I think on parchment it's a little bit trickier because it sits more on the surface, so it's easier to scrape off or be accidentally knocked off, which we find with a lot of our early records on animal skins. But I think if the paper is good quality and it's not allowing a lot of bleeding of the ink into the fibers, it generally means that good printing and good preparation of paper allows that to be stable as long as the conditions for the material are then stable. I think there's obviously been an interim period where these were, you know, pasted to walls and gates and pulled off, and some people might have acquired them in very different circumstances than simply having the office copy handed to them without it being exposed to any other environmental factors. So now it's very stably kept. So I think in terms of preservation in the future, I think these will be very stable documents. But clearly the fact that so few have survived means that the other 160 or so had an unfortunate history probably in the 20 years after they were produced. And who knows, there might still be others. I think the most recent one we found was in 2008. So there's always the chance that correspondence, letter packets, and other kind of transmission of papers across the sea will reveal other enclosures in the future. So fingers crossed that there might be more to be found.
Well, I'm quite fascinated that so many have survived, given how delicate the medium is.
That's right. I think that speaks a little bit to the importance in which they were considered at the time, in that this is information that needs to be sent to people higher up the political chain. So in that sense, people need to know what is happening on the ground in America and how these are being circulated. The information in them is as important as the physical object. And clearly, you know, we see people writing out the text again and including sections in letters, and it's finding its way into different documents as extracts as well. So the consciousness of what this declaration implies is kind of picked apart as well, so that you can see the bones of the statement reappearing either in changes of emphasis or in different sympathies in the letters. And certainly we have a big collection of intercepted material from the autumn of 75 through to summer, autumn of 76, when the British are really quite keen to hear about how the declaration might be changing, or the route to declaration might be changing people's opinions. So in that sense, you could see why there were important records to be found and analysed, I suppose, by people in colonial towns.
From a record context perspective, the enclosure of documents like the Declaration of Independence is not unusual in these kind of dispatches we see to the Colonial Secretary, to the Admiralty Secretary, things like that. For example, the version that is transmitted by the Howe brothers as peace commissioners, they also enclose various other things in that same letter. There's a New York Gazette copy from the 22nd of July, for example, which discusses sort of the establishment of new government structures in the state, the colony of New York at the time. So our documents and are sort of filled with various other pieces of paper, colonial printing, things like that, that were being sent back as sort of standard procedure. It just so happens that obviously now the importance and the sort of perceived value, political, ideological, historical value of the Declaration of Independence is higher than some of that other material. And at the time, they also recognized it as a momentous sort of change in approach by the rebels. But that explains why it has been extracted and other things might not have, but there is a large amount of original American printing also in our archives there as well.
I think we can see some of the comments in the enclosures and the letters surrounding these documents to say this document is now allowing, say, the assembly in Virginia or in New York to think about how it will adjust itself to become more of an independent body. So the British governing officials are more concerned about how that structurally changes how they must approach the people they now are negotiating with or beginning to think about a military action against, and then again how that will inspire the population to begin to flip out of their colonial position into a kind of patriotic position. So it's important as a flag, I guess, for how the British will react to the unfolding circumstances that it inspires. And in that sense, it's important. But I think they see it as another example of kind of flexing within the Continental Congress about how it's going to find its way into a position to resist the British ideologically, intellectually, as well as sort of politically. So in that sense, it's showing a good sophistication, but everybody is working with the ideas of things like common sense. So they know how this is being framed, but it's how the British suddenly have to react quite swiftly to what it implies.
I think so. And from a British perspective, from the sort of state perspective, they're very interested in who might be for and who might be against us in the colonies still. I mean, this is a large part of the British strategy, certainly for the early years of the war, and actually later on as they pivot towards the more southern theatre as well, is where might we find loyalist support and where might we find more entrenched rebellion, ideas of rebellion. So by feeding back ideas like this, by talking about things like the Declaration of Independence, by intercepting people's letters and reading how they're responding to things like the Declaration of Independence, the government is able to make these tactical decisions and redirect their efforts. Not always as well advised as they might have liked, but that is the plan behind it.
And we see a lot of activity, like the compilation of lists of loyalists and rebels quite quickly in, say, various counties in New York that Governor Tryon includes in some of his quite large packets with lots and lots of enclosures. So he's trying to assemble as much information as he can quickly and then pass that up to other politicians to make sense of, because obviously he's possibly on a ship trying to avoid being captured. So in that sense, it inspires activity. Then that creates other records, which are really interesting because it shows how up and down the social scale it's changing people's minds about where they sit in this political unfolding event.
Well, this is a story of intelligence gathering as well. As you're intercepting letters and creating lists of people, you're gathering intelligence for decision makers who are 1,000 miles away. And that's the other fascinating part of the story of how this document travels from fairly rapidly from a colonial outpost in Philadelphia to the center of the empire. I want to talk a little bit more about these intercepted letters. First, are we going to see any of these in the exhibit? And secondly, did the people whose letters were intercepted ever get those letters, or were they just stolen?
I'm really glad you asked this, because it's kind of a pet project of mine, which is that we have several different types of intercepted letters, actually, for this period at the National Archives. We are displaying various ones of these. I'll go through them in order. So the first thing that we have a very large amount of in CO5 is several boxes of letters that were intercepted by the post office. And at this time in the colonial period, starting after the Seven Years' War, really, the post office is running packet ships which transport official letters to and fro across the Atlantic. And these go from sort of key ports and key colonies. What people in both the American colonies and Britain quickly realize is that this is a very fast and reliable method of transporting your letters. So for a fee, and a reasonably steep fee, which does limit who is using this service, merchants and other persons of note or perceived note in the colonies and Britain start using this service as well. And then in response to this, the British government realizes that this is a large source of untapped information. So what they start to do is issue warrants to intercept letters from these packet ships. And Sean touched on these briefly a moment ago, but we have two particularly notable collections for the American Revolution. One from late 1775, when the British government is targeting information largely about where loyalists are, where rebels are, but also about responses to the rebel invasion of Quebec. And we also have a collection which goes through 1776, where they're much more interested in what's happening in New York, which of course at this point is a potential target for the British sort of strike back, and also in Philadelphia, where the Second Continental Congress is very busy thinking about things like independence. And these letters were picked up from the packet ships that were coming back across the Atlantic. All those packet ships go into Falmouth in Cornwall, in southwest England, and the letters are taken from Falmouth to London to the central post office, where all of them are opened and post office clerks have to go through them. There's a really nice quote from one of the post office secretary is talking about how he's just had the busiest morning of his life doing all this. And then what they do is they go through, they find interesting bits which they think the colonial secretaries, for example, the ministers in the cabinet will be interested in. They copy them out onto different pieces of paper. Very rarely with the post office do they keep the original letter. And then they stuff the letters back into their packets and send them on, which ends up with possibly my favourite part of some of these correspondences is that in the second set of letters, you get people saying, I'm pretty sure my letters have been intercepted, so I hope you get this.
Oh, dear. So as you were telling this very interesting story, I kept on thinking of the Stasi and their special letter opening devices where they would have a steamer that would allow them to open the letters and read everyone's postage. And then it made me think, of course, well, maybe the colonials were right about rebelling against an out-of-control empire.
It's definitely...
But what about seals? What about the seals? I mean, wasn't that common to seal these with a wax seal?
Yeah, yeah. Because I think the individual letters might be sent as groups and numbered so they'd be read in order. And I think the packets themselves would have to be sealed relatively waterproof to know that they're heading on a wet ship deck, potentially. So there's various steps that have to be taken to either go underneath the front of the seal and lever it off and then replace it exactly so you can't see any kind of bleed in the paper. And obviously wax is very brittle and it's meant to be broken to open it for proper reasons. So I think, you know, there's obviously a sophistication going on here, which is an attempt to disguise it as well. So I guess the clerks have got some rather crafty guys as well doing the seal breaking and reapplying the seals as well.
Or not so crafty, because they do seem to be aware that this is happening to their letters. It's actually a really interesting opportunity, I think, to talk about some of our other intercepted letter-type documents we have at the National Archives. We also have a large, vast amount of letters, thousands of letters from prize papers, some of which we'll also be displaying in the exhibition. So we're displaying some of those...
And just explain what a prize paper is for the audience, please.
Yes. So prize papers are papers that are taken from ships taken as prize, so captured by naval vessels or privateers during times of war. And the important thing about this is that you can make a lot of money by capturing prize ships, but you have to prove that it's an enemy ship. And the way you do this is by retaining all of the paperwork on that ship, whether that be the ship's papers itself, saying who owns the ship, where it sailed from, who's crewing it, or the papers on the ship about the merchant goods that might be on there, which of course is what you want to confiscate because that's where the money is, or indeed all of the private papers on the ship. Because if the case gets contested, you can look through those as well and start thinking about who is on this ship and do they have affiliations with, say, the rebels in America or later on the French? And all of this is part of a quite lengthy legal process to prove whether a ship is good prize. And good prize just means, yes, you can capture and profit off this ship. So what we have from that is essentially people capturing these ships. So your naval captains, your privateer captains would take all of the paperwork they could find. And quite often people on those ships might be trying to throw it overboard beforehand, or they could get to it, in order to prove this process. Which means that here at the National Archives, we have these boxes and sacks and bundles of people's private letters that were being sent on these ships. Because the main way to send a letter overseas at the time was just to put it on the next ship that was going to the port closest to where you wanted it to go. So all of these merchant ships and so on have these letters on them. And there's some really interesting finds in there. My favorite one that we're going to display in the Revolution 250 exhibition is a copy of a letter from Adrienne de Lafayette. So this is the Marquis de Lafayette's wife to the Marquis de Lafayette. And she's writing from Bordeaux. And she's speaking to her husband, the Marquis de Lafayette, about how the French have just entered the war. So it's a very personal letter talking about... She misses him, talking about their daughter who was born just before he left to go originally as a private soldier to America. But also she's talking about these sort of momentous events as well of the French fleet, which has just been dispatched to the Americas. So it's a really amazing blend of the sort of private impacts of war, which you get in these personal letters, and also how people react to these big events.
And what we are doing in this project as well is... We're looking at the Revolutionary War period to see exactly what kind of materials could come out of the ships, the French ships, and then American vessels that were intercepted and captured by the British Navy. And there's going to be a lot of information which we can't include in the exhibition, but we're hoping to bring onto the events around the period the exhibition is running for, to basically highlight some of these stories about evacuations from not just New York, but Charlestown and other places where there's a loyalist population who are leaving a paper trail, or it's being intercepted by Americans, and those American ships are being captured. So there's a rather complicated paper trail to follow through the prize process and the legal aspects of this, but I think we're going to find many more voices of people impacted by the war and the choices they had to make. So that's really exciting, because this material literally hasn't been opened since it was originally dispatched. So it's really new archival material for everybody.
It's really exciting. And we're working with the University of Oldenburg in Germany as well. It's a 20-year project, so we're cataloguing all of this material. So it'll be searchable on our catalog online, and we're also, it's being digitized as well. So people can read this stuff from the comfort of their own home, which is really exciting.
That's fascinating. I just recall that in some cases with the taking of these prizes and the various capturings and recapturings, it's one of my favorite stories. But some sailors changed side 20 times during the Revolutionary War, and some ships were captured multiple times. So all of these letters would be, you know, that maybe an American privateer captured a ship going back to Falmouth, and then it was recaptured before it made it, and recaptured again, and somehow this information ends up somewhere. But I have another question about those letters that your nefarious spy service was opening up. So they're keeping track of, as they should, of Patriot rebels. I'm curious, though, about the recipients of those letters then in Britain. Are they keeping track of these people as being potentially problematic radicals, the people receiving the letters? And how is that then working out? Because presumably these people in Britain receiving the letters are subjects as well, but they also have rights.
They do, yes. And this is a function of the warrant system that is required to open these letters, which seems to be, I would say, loosely interpreted at times. But what they have to do is suggest that they think someone is a person of interest in some kind of sedition or similar at either end, which does mean that they are targeting certain persons on both sides of the Atlantic. For example, we have an entire box of Benjamin Franklin's letters from the time that he was touring around Britain, and I think just before he goes to France, actually, where they're really monitoring what he's doing and trying to work out who is he talking to and what is he talking to those people about. He's obviously a person of note, and we'll be displaying one of his letters too. But there are other people on both sides who they're interested in. For example, in Britain, there's people like Henry Kruger. He is an MP, a Whig MP for Bristol. And he is one of the MPs, members of Parliament, who are more sympathetic to the American cause than others. So they're really looking through what he's sending as well. And they're very curious about who is he talking to, how close to the American cause actually is he, and also is he managing to drum up support in Britain for this kind of thing as well, because they don't want to lose sort of popular support in Britain for what is already a very unpopular government.
What's really interesting as well is how these letters demonstrate the connectedness between Britain and the American colonies in the 18th century. I suppose it shows a lot of different families, a lot of different merchants, a lot of people in the port cities like Liverpool, Glasgow, Bristol have got very deep connections to America. And the correspondence is about sometimes ideas, but it's also about importing teapots or how we're going to get, you know, the tea into Boston, the kind of things which spark the problems, you know, early on with the Stamp Act and the Tea Act, because it's that commercial and personal connection. So in a way, they're intercepting a very rich stream of information, which is already flowing and has been, you know, since the 1660s in the same kind of level, in the same kind of way. So it does give you a very good snapshot of how America and Britain have related to each other at this level away from government, maybe more in a commercial sense, but also personal links between people. And in that sense, it then leads you to say, well, this conflict was obviously very difficult for people to accommodate in their thinking about how they sit as Britons in America, as potentially shifting towards an independent position because of this intolerable imposition from Westminster, from Parliament, and from the King, ultimately. So in that sense, it gives us a good snapshot of the way lives were lived and how people talked about themselves.
It's also quite interesting, I think, that they're not just targeting letters by people they suspect of being rebellious or rebel sympathizers. Actually, numerically, the largest single amount of people seem to be expressing loyalist sympathies. I did some work on one of these boxes, which is CO5134, and sort of counting through who they're actually looking at. And of all the letters in there, the largest single number of them seem to be loyalists, and they're talking about the issues that they're having in places they might be, like New York, where they're sort of coming up against what is increasingly sort of like a hardline rebel environment. And again, I think this is part of the British government looking for loyalist support around the colonies, where they can target, where they might want to start a sort of military incursion to strike back against the rebels. And a lot of people actually also seem to have very unclear loyalties as well. They're still deciding. This is very early, really, in the conflict. I think there's a tendency for us to think of 1776, Declaration of Independence, everything is settled ideologically with sort of a binary opposition between British and American. But a lot of these people still see themselves as British or British-American to a certain extent. And they are unsure how to cope with these kinds of situations they're being thrown into. And that's what they're mostly talking about. They talk about how the military developments affect them, how the economy is affecting them. They can't get food. They can't sell anything. The currency is valueless now. All these kinds of things, which they also think will be of interest, as Sean says, to people on the other side of the Atlantic. You can't sell grain here in New York, for example, is something we hear quite a lot. Or if I send you a bill of sale, it might have no value, stuff like that.
I'm fascinated by the interest in intelligence gathering for a number of reasons, because one could argue that the British response to the American War of Independence comes down to something like an intelligence failure. That despite all of this opening of letters they were doing, despite their very, very excellent intelligence gathering operation, they were overestimating the support of King George and of Parliament. They were overestimating loyalism in the colonies, and they were underestimating at the same time how they should calibrate their own responses to what was happening. And each time that they chose a response, the British government, it ended up alienating more and more people. So they were kind of on this deathly feedback loop of presuming that there was support, wanting to react against inappropriate things that rebels were doing, but choosing the wrong solution each time.
It is interesting when you think about the military activity and the fact that there's not very many decisive battles and they're small scale. So the military activity seems to be happening in a bit of a military operational bubble, and it's actually the people's belief in the various counties that the armies are passing through and the impact of those preparations for fighting and the consequences of the fighting rather than the actual casualties and how that impacts the movement of troops. That's what really matters. And the British maybe see this too much as a military attempt to just defeat a rebel army and not really considering how the population's attitude has changed, because the cause which sparked that rebellion in the first place is one of effects on everybody else, which is the taxation, the control of imports, and all those other effects Graham just mentioned, you know, in terms of how the price of things goes up and the value of the currency goes down. So all these things are real day-to-day kind of grinding issues, which in the background of a war are really are going to change people's opinions about who was responsible for this. And it's obviously going to be the British, because I think the drive to then blame the king for all of this, having kind of led Parliament down this route and the proclamation of rebellion overlapping with the Olive Branch petition, kind of gives you the sense that they've missed out on how the perception of whose fault this is has flipped from, you know, being the military kind of presence of the British troops in garrison towns, the quartering and the harbouring of food, that kind of thing. It's become this blend of ideas, the responsibility of the big government trying to squash these colonial lives, and how then the escalation of the military response is just the final trigger to persuade people that they should take sides against the British. So all of that is part of the intelligence process, and sometimes the infighting in the colonial administration, you know, even back to the 1760s, you can see how governors are fighting assembly members to get the British government's position pushed through into the way colonies are managed. So I think that's a longer process of kind of decline and decay and control. But the kind of military response and the necessity of that, as the British saw it, is what tips a lot more people into this position of opposition to the British government and their representatives.
I think it's a really interesting talking point in the sense that you're right, there is such a vast amount of intelligence gathering going on. But I wonder if it's sort of this failure on the part of the British government at this time and the hubris of the sort of the North Ministry at this time, and the earlier ministries, I would argue, up from the Seven Years' War onwards, is to focus on the kinds of people they are looking at with this kind of intelligence gathering. We talk about the packet ships, for example. These are mainly picking up letters by wealthier merchants, people with these transatlantic connections. They're still connected to Britain, and it's a certain demographic, a certain subset of society whose opinions are being picked up. And it's amazing that we have them, but what it only touches on but doesn't directly show is the opinions of the far larger numbers of people in North America who are less attached to Britain. They don't have these financial connections. They don't have these kinds of links and sympathies that cross back to Britain. Their letters aren't in there because they're not writing these letters. They're not sending them on the packets. There's a really interesting quote in one of the letters we're using for the exhibition. It's by an anonymous writer in New York, but he's talking about how there is, a quote here, great talk of independence, and the unthinking multitudes are mad for it. So he's obviously got a very clear idea of who he thinks is in support of independence. And this is a theme we see, is that wealthier people in the colonies, because they profit from being part of the British imperial system, they still want to stay in that system. Aside from a very few specific, more extreme opinions in Congress, the majority of people originally are thinking about how do we get back into the British system with more favourable terms that will help us profit as colonial actors. Ordinary people aren't thinking like that anymore. And I think that is what the British lose sight of. They lose sight of the fact that, as Sean says, the logistical difficulties of conducting a conflict in North America, particularly on coastal Northeast America, is such a complex coastline. There's so many individual little settlements, all of which they can influence how you can or can't access areas of that country. Because you need those naval links, that maritime link, to get up and down this coast, to even push slightly into the interior. You need those rivers, you need those bays, you need those, I mean, obviously, there are several key examples here, but it's all up and down the coast. And they lose those settlements, they lose those people, and I think that is what they haven't realized yet. It's already happened by 1776. That majority has started to shift.
When we see the lists of loyalists and what the British call rebels in these county lists that the governors are compiling, it's immediately obvious that there's a sudden split. As soon as an opportunity to galvanize around one or other of the causes, people have made decisions, and then there is some evidence of bullying and intimidation, and on both sides, you know, physical violence. But clearly, by the time we get the evidence of these lists of sympathies and sympathizers being created, that's already shifted people's minds. So in a way, the intelligence is already behind the wave, and people have made their choices as they can be recorded, but that implies there's a much bigger group of people who are waiting to probably join the Patriot side, because as things get worse, they're going to be blaming the British for the long-term causes of this.
I'm recalling the story of the various loyalty oaths, and as we know with the loyalty oaths that were signed, if you're presented a loyalty oath by a soldier with a musket and a bayonet in your face, you're likely to sign it. But if the other side comes and says, well, you should renounce that oath, well, if he puts a bayonet in your face, you'll renounce that oath. And then the cataloging of who was loyal and who was not obviously just becomes an exercise in a futile exercise, I should say. But I want to go back to these ideas about what we see in those intercepted letters, and also maybe what we see in those original letters that accompanied the first Dunlap broadsides that you have in your collection. The litany of complaints in the Declaration of Independence, the name-calling is pretty extreme. To what extent are these people commenting on the actual content, like the ad hominem attacks against their king?
That's a really interesting question in terms of the original enclosing letters, because they're actually not at all concentrating on that. They're far more focused on what this means strategically, what this means for the institution of new colonial governance structures, how new they were or not. It does, the Declaration of Independence means that they are now dealing with people in colonial America who have decided to take on themselves a right to argue for their own point and to litigate with people like Richard Howe and William Howe on their own standing. They're no longer coming at this on sort of like a we are above you colonial footing. They are now having to talk to people as equals. Whether they believe that or not, I think you could argue that a lot of the British officials see this as very much an upstart move, but that is what they now have to do. So they're much more focused on that, whereas the personal letters, I think, are more engaging with the ideological aspects.
And I think the fact that they blamed Parliament for so long for driving the policy which was constraining the colonies and limiting how they could function, I think the appeal to the King to try and intervene with that through the 1760s and 70s, before the conflict really emerged. We see that in the Olive Branch petition, there's still a gripe about Parliament being the root cause of this, and the frustration of nothing happening kind of moves the point of focus to the King himself, because in a medieval leftover almost, they can see him as the feudal overlord of the government that's acting in his name. So in that sense, he's kind of up there to be targeted anyway, because that's the way the British system is still set up. But it's actually the Parliament's determination to drive through these policies which has already caused the switch in belief that something must be done beyond complaining, because complaining has got them nowhere anyway. So in that sense, it doesn't really matter what the King's position is. He's an institution in this rather than an individual, and in that sense they can target him, because that's how you get the entire British system encapsulated in a problem or a solution which they're trying to address through the language of the Declaration.
Let me just rephrase my question a little bit then. What I was getting at is understanding the audience of the Declaration better. So Jefferson is writing to convince maybe the third of people who are sitting on the fence that this is really important. He's also writing to the people who agree with him to just sort of buttress the position. Obviously, people who don't agree with him in the British government is going to be reading this in a different way. But going back to the idea of the intelligence failure, if they're just worried about the strategic implications and not paying attention to the content, right, that's another kind of really important point where you would see some misunderstanding of what's really going on. This isn't just the colonists continuing to complain. These complaints are really important. They need to be dealt with somehow. And again, it doesn't seem like they're being, it's like the document isn't actually being understood in the way that it's being received by its primary audience in the colonies.
I think that's true. I think there seems to be a lack of immediate analysis of why the document is written in the way it is. I mean, we can talk here about sort of how it harks back to these previous ideas of liberties in a sort of British value system over the past sort of 150 years before this point, really. It is tapping into these ideas. It taps into these ideas that come around with the English Civil War, which come around with the Glorious Revolution, things like that. The way it's written, it very much calls back to those same kinds of grievances where you talk about tyranny and an unjust government. And these are ideas that people in colonial America, also in Britain, to be fair, at the same time, are engaging with. I mean, we have common sense, for example, which is also something that gets talked about in the intercepted letters, how people are reading that in such vast numbers. All these kinds of ideas of why should a government exist in the way it does, and when should you start thinking about getting rid of one if, say, you have these grievances against King George III or against his ministry at the time. And I don't think they're engaging with that directly. What is interesting is that there is some engagement later on, I think, when they start to realize that this is something they need to take more seriously. So about 2 years later, in 1778, so January 1778, a manuscript copy of one of our Dunlaps, actually, is laid before the House of Lords to be debated. So they are then, in 1778, starting to think about what's going on here. what are the grievances and how can we actually think about how much of a mess we're in? But that takes quite a long time.
Right, that's a really interesting story. Eventually, of course, in 1778, the war isn't necessarily going well for either side, but at this point, it's like one of these classic things. And whenever we talk about this, I'm thinking about the recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. When did politicians and the leaders finally figure out that something is going horribly wrong and some of our assumptions aren't quite what we thought they'd be? But anyway, I want to go back away from what Parliament and governments are deciding and maybe think about your exhibit. And you mentioned at the very start how it's also trying to focus on the experience of individual people, normal people, Black loyalists, women, Indigenous people. So why don't we just focus on that for a little bit now?
Yeah, I suppose we started first with Indigenous people. I was doing a bit of work with the Haudenosaunee Nation, the Six Nations in upstate New York, just looking at their position in the whole of the British colonial experience and taking it back to the, I guess, the medieval kind of crusading papal bulls that allowed the Portuguese and Spanish to colonize and conquer, and how that is brought to the American continent, you know, when the British first or the English first begin to arrive. But then moving that into the period of the Revolutionary War, how does a different way of thinking about history and recording events sit alongside the archival paper trail that we're used to using to give us information about events in the past? So it was very important to lock into that different perspective, because obviously it does intersect with the story, with the Sullivan-Clinton campaign and with all of the activities for forging alliances on both sides and using the skills of Indigenous people to move armies around and to basically evade large numbers of troops from conflict points. So in that sense, it's a really different perspective. It's certainly one that the British won't have heard in this history before. So we've spent a lot of time interviewing representatives and leaders linked through Syracuse University in New York, because they have a good program which is getting us to the institutional memory of the Six Nations, I guess you could call it. And we're really getting some good perspective on how they still are attached to these stories in a very disturbing way. You know, they still feel this as events which would be recent to us in the way we calculate time and its impact, the events and their impact on people. So that's been really interesting. We've got an awful lot of footage and audio to work through to kind of think about, mainly focusing on Sullivan Clinton and people like Joseph Brandt as people in both worlds who could represent, in their own view, an Indigenous perspective, but also have a British perspective as well. And that's, again, something that's been challenged by our investigation and listening to those Indigenous voices. And it just means that we can see there's been a knock-on effect as well. So certainly the Cherokee Nation is very interested now in collecting information about the treaties that affected its lands in the Ohio Valley over the course of the British colonial period. So it's the revolutionary anniversary is being used as a way to take stock of where a lot of Indigenous rights are, how they sit with state and federal governments, how the basis of land occupation and land ownership is challenged, and how that's been a seam that runs right through the colonial story on some rather shaky foundations in some areas. Some that are legally sound, but it's a very interesting exploration for us because the older archive is now being reused as a way of informing a very different perspective and a different aim. So surfacing those voices and those perspectives has been really interesting for us in how it sits through and alongside a kind of colonial administration and structure that created the archive that we're familiar with.
Yeah, and of course, as you were talking about Indigenous peoples, the final grievance against King George, of course, mentions the phrase, the merciless Indian savages, who King George has now incited to wage war against us colonists. So very directly, an attitude about Indigenous peoples is there, kind of right at the heart of the founding of the American experience and the American nation. Graham?
Yes, I think with that in mind, this focusing on this kind of topic allows us to think about how the story of the American Revolution, of independence in America fits into this sort of bigger picture, this longer story, which is really the story of Northern European colonialism in North America and how that affects indigenous nations there as well. So you mentioned, of course, that one of the grievances in the Declaration of Independence is the sort of incitement to warfare by, quoting, merciless Indian savages. But also one of the sort of earlier incitements towards rebellion in the Americas is, of course, the restriction on colonists to how far west they can settle. And the various settlements that we have so many records on in the archives here between British colonial authorities and the Department for Indian Affairs, for example, who are active in that theatre at the time, trying to settle where those boundary lines might be. This is just part of a larger story of disputed land, disputed territory, disputed resources in North America. And I think sitting it within that story allows us to think about how all of those factors, wanting to move further west, wanting to grab these resources, are part of sort of the inciting elements of the American Revolution.
And you're talking about looking at the wider story that predates the Declaration and carries on after it. We were talking about the Native American experience, but maybe we can talk about the experience of Africans as well, because slavery predated and obviously postdated the Declaration. And indeed, you said there are some Black loyalist experiences that feature in your exhibition.
Certainly. And one of the earlier items that we're going to feature in the exhibition are these sort of vast books, tomes we have of customs accounts here at the National Archives. And they show imports and exports to and from the American colonies. And one thing they do show is the economic reliance of particularly the southern colonies on the practice of enslavement and on the resources and the labor that can be generated, forced labor, through enslavement. And we use that as a jumping off point, really, to start thinking about, and again, this is one of the other elements mentioned in the Declaration, this idea of domestic insurrections, which of course is a sort of thinly veiled reference to the Dunmore Proclamation, which offers freedom to anyone enslaved by rebels. I think it's important to note that it's enslaved by rebels, not just any enslaved person in Virginia, if they'll fight on the British side. And later the Phillipsburg Proclamation, which extends that to any enslaved person enslaved by a rebel in any of the 13 colonies. And we sort of pick up the Black Loyalist story from there, from this offer of freedom, but it's a very dangerous offer of freedom. We've also been talking to people from the Black Loyalist Heritage Center up in Nova Scotia, because after 1783, large numbers of Black Loyalists ended up in Nova Scotia and still have a presence there today. So there's still a community, strong community of Black Loyalists in Nova Scotia today, of descendants thereof. We've been working with them to talk about what that history means for them. So we follow the story of Black Loyalists through our records throughout the American Revolutionary period. But we're also interested in how the American Revolution, for many people, is a very live piece of history. I think that's something which certainly our British audiences here, the domestic audience, don't think about it very much. It's not something we think of as having current impacts, but it really, really does for various people in North America, but also on both sides of the Atlantic today.
And I think it's interesting to pick up some of these stories of people who leave America, you know, either from New York or from other places in 1782-83, and come back to London in some cases, and we can pick up their claims for compensation as loyalists. And there's some really good stories of former enslaved people who've become emancipated through the proclamations, settling in London, reconstructing some of their life, and you can see in their statements and their testimonies what their journey has been to that point where they can claim and demonstrate their loyalty to the Crown. So you can pick up different strands of what it was like to be in America in this period of the war, but also beforehand, and how that transformation in people's circumstances happened, how in many ways the war shook things up.
All right, gentlemen, thank you so much. Well, we're coming to the end of the interview. You know, I started by talking about the importance of learning the story about how this document spread, the printing of this document, and then it makes its way to admirals and generals and crosses the Atlantic, and it eventually finds its way in a spy's basement in the post office, perhaps, and then goes on somewhere else, and eventually it officially makes its way into the Continental Archives, and it goes from there to the new building, into the basement, and then here 250 years later, some diligent archivists like you can take it out and do a wonderful exhibition about these fantastic Dunlap broadsides and all of these other intercepted letters and fascinating things connected to the Declaration of Independence. So I ask all my guests as we end, though, here we are 250 years later. What is your main takeaway from all the work you've done on preparing for this exhibition?
I think I'm always still amazed by the sheer complexity of what's going on in North America at this time, and just the different viewpoints of different people with different issues, grievances, wants, and needs that shows up in our archive. It's kind of staggering, and it's been quite difficult to try and condense that down into a narrative for an exhibition, but I always really enjoy seeing just that sheer complexity of it, I think.
I suppose my takeaway is linked to that. It's the fact that the archive is so rich, and when you actually address it with a theme of trying to extract a narrative or a story or a series of stories, you suddenly realize how much information is captured by a bureaucracy in the past and how immediate that can then become as you reassemble it and try and make those stories flow through the events you know from established history or the big picture, which has kind of been what we've been taught. But actually diving into individual records, you get a sense always of how humans have to react to really uncomfortable and difficult situations. And I think that's come across very nicely, that the evidence is great. We can tell a story at that level of individual experience and tie it onto these big themes and big grand ideas about liberty and freedom and all of this. But actually, that means something to everybody in their individual circumstances. We can see that 250 years later.
It's a perspective shift, isn't it, really? Yeah. I think we know the political story to some extent. We know the military story. But what we now get is the real human story, the personal story. And it's the same records many times. Keep finding new stuff, of course. But it's about looking at them from a different angle.
Dr. Graham Moore, Dr. Sean Cunningham, thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to the exhibition.
Thank you.
Thank you. Liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americatzentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americatzentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americatzentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americatzentrum.de. Thanks for listening.